on to case number 3, and that is 093706, Rutherford versus Judge and Dolph et al. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Smith representing the appellants. Your Honor, we're seeking a reversal of the district court's ruling where it dismissed plaintiff's complaint that had been brought under the Labor Management Act 301. The judge basically found, contrary to our allegations, that there was no existing collective bargaining agreement, also called a CBA. Further, the judge had made a ruling that he didn't believe that Teamster 705 had done anything wrong in our allegation of failure to represent felt.
So Mr. Smith, Local 705 writes a letter to J&D November 16, 2006, in which the sentence appears, Local 705 does not desire to continue or extend the current CBA beyond its expiration date of March 31, 2007. So my question for you is, why is that not an unequivocal statement that the local itself was saying this contract is going to be terminated, maybe we'll negotiate a successor contract? I'm well aware that there are all sorts of rules about what happens during the negotiation period, but it sure looks to me like the CBA on which you're relying terminated in accordance to with its terms, and there was an override of the Evergreen Clause, if you want, March 31, 2007.
Well, I think we have to look at the conduct of the parties.
Well, I'm looking at their words. I mean, the conduct can't trump the words of termination, can it?
Well,
why do you turn to parole evidence, put it that way, if the actual written commitments of the parties say the contract's over?
But as this court had found in Wood, there are certain things that even though there's a letter that's terminating the relationship, it's the conduct of the parties thereafter that make and determine that the collective bargaining agreement is still in effect. I believe.
But aren't you getting the cart before the horse? I mean, if there's a clear, if there's ambiguity, if there's no letter, if there is some kind of ambiguity, as there has been in some cases, then it's entirely appropriate to look at course of dealing with the parties, what else is going on. But do we even reach that point here?
Well, I think, again, Your Honor, based on the line of cases that came out, including the Wood case, would tend to show that there can be some ambiguity whether is terminate and negotiate used. I understand that it says that the CBA will no longer be followed, but it was. The parties continued to pay wages. The parties.
That's your only real piece of evidence, I think. The company indicates that just about everything else it was doing was either something that was an ongoing obligation post-termination or, in some instances, observing the standstill sort of obligations that you have while you're negotiating in good faith for a new contract.
And that's correct, Your Honor, because they maintain this relationship all the way
through. But it's not because there's a contract. The only piece of evidence I think that you have is the fact that the dues deductions happened.
And I think that's an important issue because.
But it's only one piece of evidence. Is it enough to trump the plain language of this letter?
But there has been no detrimental reliance by the company.
Why does that matter, though?
Well, I think by showing that the parties wanted to continue the status quo and they wanted to continue having no strike.
But there's a legal obligation on the part of employers until there's been bargaining to impasse.
But also the
status quo.
Obviously, Teamster could have walked away. And instead, they continued to negotiate. They continued to provide the services under the CBA.
You know, you seem to concede in the brief that you need discovery in order to establish Local 705's intent. And isn't that tantamount to an admission that you've not adequately pled the case?
Well, Your Honor, under normal circumstances, possibly, but we're also looking at a different situation where 705 filed charges that were accepted by the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Board believed that there were certain things that Judge Indolf had not done that violated the National Labor Relations Act. So without us having a chance to do discovery, we have no power. We have no power to force the National Labor Relations Board to give us the documents that would help us establish some of the things that are in our complaint about the failure of Judge Indolf to maintain the collective bargaining agreement.
And is that how you think you could amend the complaint to fix the problems that the district court saw here? Because you argued that amendments to the complaint wouldn't be futile, but you didn't propose any amendments. And
well, the judge dismissed the case with prejudice. It was pretty much impossible to request an amended complaint.
But I'm wondering how you could have amended the complaint to fix the problem.
Well, I think some of the things that we're alleging as far as the wages being paid and the benefits that were being received, which I think also is another point that they continue to receive, the benefits that flowed from the collective bargaining agreement beside the dues checkoff.
Can I ask you this? Have you abandoned your emotional distress claim?
Yes.
Okay. So that takes care of this possible jurisdictional issue that was...
That was, I think, taken off the board in our reply to the motion to dismiss, response to motion to dismiss.
I had one other question that I wanted to ask you, because you appeared to take conflicting positions of whether the district court treated this as a motion to dismiss under 12b-6 or a summary judgment, because in your opening brief you call it a dismissal, and in the reply you refer to it as summary judgment. Was it summary judgment is to Judge Indolf and dismissal is to Local 705? What's going on?
The only one that had motion for summary judgment was the International Brothers of Teamsters, which the judge really didn't rule as a summary judgment. I think the summary judgment issue was just brought up by the appellees. Basically, they were looking at that the judge was considering documents that I had proposed in my response, where I had filed certain affidavits showing the benefits and the dues checkoffs and the continuation of wages that were under the collective bargaining agreement, that based on that, the appellees were trying to insinuate because of that, that there was a possibility that the judge had really converted this to summary judgment. But he did a 12b-6, and that was his final order. But I believe...
So it's your position it never got converted, and had it been converted, maybe you would have asked for more discovery time or what have you?
That's correct. I think I would have had an opportunity, was a summary judgment, to have done depositions on anybody who filed affidavits. I also believe that the judge had a right to take in consideration any documents that would have been relevant to the cause of action as we stated, which I believe was not in our brief, but it's just something that I came across, was Metz versus Ritza, which was a 2010 case, where a judge can look at documents that are not part of the complaint as being able to adjudicate and take notice of those documents.
Well, that's not an unlimited right, but, I mean, if, say, the collective bargaining agreement, normally you should attach those to the complaint. So, do you want to say anything about the statute of limitations?
I believe the statute of limitations, Your Honor, really can't be considered because for having a labor management 301, we have to find the main ingredient is that the union has failed in its duty to protect its members. So without having a cause of action against a union, we really can't bring anything as far as a 301 because we wouldn't meet the two prong, the collective bargaining agreement violation and the adequate representation. So the union members really had to wait out the issue of the grievances. Each one of these plaintiffs lost their position.
Well, it's both the grievances and the underlying backdrop of this jurisdictional dispute between 705 and 744, right?
But if we would have brought an action against this Judgendahl for violating a collective bargaining agreement, they certainly would have been coming in saying that we hadn't exhausted our administrative remedy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Who's going to go first, Mr. Peters or Mr. Gilbert?
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, I'm Greg Peters on behalf of Judge Indahl. Mr. Gilbert and I have decided to agree to split up the time. I'll take 8 minutes. And there's really four issues. And if it's acceptable to the court, the breach of the collective bargaining agreement, the statute of limitations issue, amending, and there's amending the complaint, and I'll call it a pleading deficiency issue. Mr. Gilbert,
yes.
We've decided that he'll handle the amending the complaint and the pleading deficiency issue because it really revolves around 705, if that's acceptable to the court, and I'll handle the statute of limitations and the breach of the collective bargaining
agreement. So could you start with whether it's the company's practice to always continue to deduct union dues from employees after the expiration of a collective bargaining agreement?
There's nothing in the record as to a standard practice, Your Honor. This was a 12B motion, and the complaint doesn't say anything about
so
a standard
why,
well, practice.
Then in this particular case, why did the company continue to deduct the union dues if the collective bargaining agreement had expired?
There's not the record is not developed. As I said, it was a motion to dismiss, and there's no allegations that there was no inquiry into the company's intent. You could say, well, the company's intent was to keep labor peace, not to cut off the union's revenue stream. It could be something as innocent as it was on autopilot in the payroll system and nobody brought it to anybody's attention. The people kept working and nobody changed their authorizations and it just was on autopilot. But there hasn't been any discovery to get into the intent or why it happened.
You cited to Judge Indahl's refusal arbitrate the plaintiff's grievances as antithetical. I'm having problems with English today. To continuing the CBA as evidence that the CBA had been terminated. Couldn't it equally be evidence that Judge Indahl was breaching the CBA? I mean, on a motion to dismiss, construing that in plaintiff's favor, how do you think we should draw the conclusion that you draw from the refusal to arbitrate?
Well, going back to Your Honor's initial question, you start with the text of the agreement, the reopener clause, or the termination clause, and the text of the letter. It's clear. And the union went so far as to clarify its position to make it very clear that it's terminating. And contracts are bilateral. And the grievance machinery is a creature of contract. And my client, and the allegations are in paragraph 30 of the complaint, that we told the union we're not going to arbitrate any grievances. And so that's an indication that the contract is no longer in effect. And let's assume, and it goes to the statute of limitations issue also, is there was a question to Mr. Smith earlier that, well, his answer was we had to wait until the NLRB charges were resolved before we had a duty of fair representation claim to bring against the union. There's three different disputes that Mr. Smith has tried to weave together. There's the termination of these employees, the alleged terminations. There's a jurisdictional dispute between the two Teamster locals, and there's the NLRB charges.
But, you know, all of that does interact with each other, and the fact of the matter is it's not until March 2009 that the NLRB charges are all settled and they're done and over with, and it's only 1 month later that this lawsuit is filed. So since, as you correctly say, a number of things are going on, the union's trying to sort out given the change of form and the ownership shifts that are going on at Judge and Dolph, and lots of other things. They're all interwoven together. Then they wind up with this global settlement, whatever you may think of that, you know, 25 cents on the dollar perhaps. And then there's a month later, the suit is filed. Well, that would be well within the 180 days that one has, right?
If it's the claim accrues when the NLRB dismisses the charges or there's a settlement reached. But with all due respect, the claim accrued when this is a breach of contract claim under 185, breach of a collective bargaining agreement.
But there's confusion about who gets to speak for these people that persists for quite some time. I could well imagine that if they had filed the suit sooner, you'd be here saying that they failed to exhaust.
Not under the contract. The exhaustion is under the contract, and the contract has a procedure that you've got to basically seek arbitration within 45 days of a discharge. There's two steps, but it adds up to 45 days. Everybody knew that didn't happen. So the individuals could say, Judge Dolph, you breached the collective bargaining agreement by firing me, and by the union not seeking an arbitration or seeking to compel arbitration through the judicial system, you've breached your duty of fair representation because I'm still out of work. You've got to pursue this. Now, the union may say, well, we're pursuing it at the NLRB. That's a different forum, but that doesn't toll the statute of limitations under the contract, and this is a breach of contract action. And so that's why I think it's inappropriate to confuse the different forums as seeking remedies or rights in one forum.
What's a duty of fair representation action? That's a little different from a breach of contract.
Under a hybrid 301,
yeah.
There's two elements. So there's the breach of contract and a duty of fair representation.
Right.
But the breach, what should have been alleged within 6 months of September 13th of 2008.
But have they failed in their duty of fair representation while they, there's an underlying breach of contract, okay, that's happened, but they're trying to address that through NLRB proceedings. Have they actually violated their duty of fair representation by going to the board? That's an interesting theory.
That would probably be a union's defense. I'm not speaking for the union. That could be the union's defense to a DFR claim, is that we didn't because we're pursuing a similar remedy in a different forum. But it doesn't go to when the claim accrues, though. The claim accrued, the last claim accrued on about September 13, 2008.
Why does that make sense, though? Because suppose they did go to the board and the board ruled in 705's favor on the jurisdictional dispute and the board says, 100 cents in the dollar. Then there's no dispute. They get their jobs back, maybe. So you want us to jump in early before the board can fix things?
Yes, because it's a different forum. It's a breach of contract. And the duty was breached when the union didn't seek arbitration from the company or through the judicial action to compel arbitration. That's when the claim accrued for the breach of contract. Now, they still may pursue similar remedies from the labor board, but they're here on breach of contract action. And just by seeking similar remedies in a different form doesn't toll the statute for the breach of contract action. I see my time is up.
I know you have to sit down now.
Thank you.
You have to let Mr. Gilbert come up here. Hey, Mr. Gilbert.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Jeffrey Gilbert, and along with Phil Snelling, my partner, we represent 705. From their complaint through every brief filed in both courts and their argument today, the Rutherford employees characterized Local 705's conduct as arbitrary or undertaken as in bad faith. But Iqbal and Twombly put a burden on claimants to go beyond such adverse characterizations. Those cases require plaintiffs to allege some facts, which, if true, support a plausible claim. The Rutherford employees have been challenged at every point in this litigation to assert a fact, any fact, that would support a plausible claim against Local 705 that it acted arbitrarily or in bad faith.
But could I ask you another question? Once the Teamsters resolve the jurisdictional dispute and they decide that 744 is going to be going forward, the union that represents these employees, Under what authority was 705 continuing to pursue these grievances before the board?
We went to the IBT on 744 and said, we've got to get this solved or move it to somebody's jurisdiction some way. And the first thing we did was presented a united front, tried to get it settled, got it settled, and it's that settlement that's now being attacked.
So it was under the authority of the IBO, the international Teamsters, that they basically said, we're delegating to you the follow-up on these.
Yes, and 744 joined those negotiations. They were there in the room with us. We negotiated the settlement together, and as part of the settlement, 705 then ceded full authority going forward to 744. So it was an attempt to deal with, as I think you characterized it, this mass of conflicting problems that we were all dealing with at the time, not just with regard to Judge and Dolph, but with regard to the problems within the union, and that's how it got resolved.
If we find, as Judge and Dolph is urging, that the CBA had expired, that would also be the end of the complaint against Local 705, or not?
It would. That's correct. You have to prove all the elements of the right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you don't still have a duty of fair representation on expired contracts.
No, Your Honor. I think we view this a little differently, although both routes get you to the same result. An arbitrator would not have been controlled by a case like your case in Baker or any outside case. An arbitrator would have interpreted the contract as he or she saw fit and perhaps would have disagreed with Baker or thought it didn't apply. So that there was certainly the possibility, at least theoretically, that we could have convinced an arbitrator that the contract was still alive under the Evergreen Clause. That being said, however, an arbitrator would have known of Baker. Judge Dolph wasn't going to let him forget it. And we had to recognize the possibility that an arbitrator might well have followed Baker, not because he was controlled to do so, but because he found it convincing, right? In the face of that, that was one of the many risks that 705 confronted in going forward. We could lose because an arbitrator would agree with Baker. And when you know there's a basis on which you could lose the litigation, and somebody says, so how would you like to take some money to get rid of it, and not an insubstantial amount of money, it's 25 cents on the dollar, Your Honor, but 25 cents on the dollar is better than nothing. And that wasn't our only risk. We also had the risk imposed by Judge Indolf's argument that the LLC was a new company that didn't owe the obligations that the limited did. Now, our position in the underlying litigation, of course, was that that was wrong, that they were really the same two companies. But again, we're not stupid. We know we could lose that argument, and that if we do, that's going to sink our case, too. Another risk that presents us with a problem. And then, to top it off, the IBT comes along and says, we don't even want you to do this, and if you persist in it, we're going to put you in trusteeship, which would have ended union democracy at Local 705, because of the trusteeship. And let's remember, there's about 14,000 members of 705, of which this is a small group. Putting all those things together, we said, let's see if we can solve this. And we did. We got a settlement. Now, the Rutherford employees say it's not good enough. But one of the keys under the rubric of this law is that courts don't second-guess union leaders in deciding whether a settlement is adequate or not, unless there's some sort of evidence that the union leaders acted arbitrarily or based on some form of unlawful discrimination or in bad faith somehow. And that's what we've challenged the Rutherford employees to put forward. They've never done it. What they said in their complaint and what they really emphasized.
Do you think that belongs in the complaint? The
yes, and I also think that given all the evidence they put in the record, they just reinforced the understanding that what 705 did here is settle the case. It balanced the risks that it would lose if it proceeded against the 25 cents on the dollars that it was being offered and said, we better take it. And the question is not whether that's a good settlement or not. That was for the union leaders to decide. The question is only when a union balances the risks of going ahead with litigation against what they're being offered, and they make the judgment, we better take what we're being offered because the risks here are substantial, does that violate the duty of fair representation? I think there are a slew of cases that say, no, that can't violate the duty of fair representation. That's exactly what union leaders have to do. They have to be sort of steely-eyed, honestly appreciating the risks and the possible advantage, make those kind of determinations, make it with regard to all of their members.
Now, should we agree with Judge Leinenweber, would you think that the proper way to proceed would be to affirm on summary judgment grounds for Judge Indolph, but dismissal for failure to state a claim for the local?
I think it depends on how you resolve that contract question, because, of course, I agree with you. If you think there was no contract, that the Evergreen Clause does not extend the contract, and no arbitrator could have found that it did, then, seems to me, it doesn't get past the motion to dismiss, even with regard to the company. On the other hand, if there was a question about the contract, then I suppose that question would have had to move to summary judgment for the company, but not for the local, because there was never even an allegation.
My problem is that the court considered extraneous evidence that, to me, looks essentially like it was turned into a motion for...
I can't tell. I can't tell whether Judge Leinenweber considered that evidence or not. It was put in the record. I would say this. I don't think in the end it matters, because under either standard, the plaintiffs didn't have it. And if there was a motion to dismiss available for the union, which I think there was, that is, they never got past the burden of even pleading that the union did anything that was arbitrary or in bad faith, then that defeats that claim, and since the plaintiffs have to win on both claims to win anything, it defeats all the claims, and that's the end of the case.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Smith have?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Again, I'd like to maybe start with 705, because basically they're the ones that jeopardize my clients. They're the ones that have a motive that they needed to injure my clients, because the International Brotherhood of Teamsters gave them a directive. The directive, though, only was going to the jurisdictional issue between Teamster 705 and Teamster 744.
Now, but, see, your complaint is that you don't like the settlement.
Well, it's not
but
just...
you have to show bad faith, or you have to show discrimination by the union. I mean, are you is your bottom line argument here that the settlement is so outrageous on its face that it evidences bad faith?
No.
Because you seem to be saying that you can't show bad faith unless you go on some sort of discovery and...
Well, the circumstances...
You know, I'm worried that discovery is... that you're requesting is kind of like a fishing expedition.
Well, I think it's more of the circumstantial things that counsel sort of admitted to. They admit that they had received a letter from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters saying, drop the jurisdictional issue with the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board. Right after that, they go in with Judge Indolph, and he immediately come up with a settlement. The settlement is jeopardizing the clients. They're losing their benefits. They're losing their vesting for the union.
But don't you, are you taking issue with what Mr. Gilbert depicted as various areas of legal uncertainty? Settlements are usually resolved against a background of uncertainty, and nobody walks away with everything. And here, you know, 20 maybe should have been 50 cents in the dollar or something, but you know, settlements are often like that.
But we're not looking at just like a settlement into a wrongful termination or something. We're looking at a settlement that encompassed certain rights that they already had filed with the National Labor Relations Board that the Judge Indolph did not have a right to require the Teamster 705 to file applications. They also didn't have a right to fire those people for not filling out.
I understand there were a lot of things, but at the end of the day, these kinds of issues are often reduced to monetary terms, and if the settlement had been, say, for $300,000, not I'm using round numbers, you know, I don't know if we would be. I mean, in other words, you've got to sort of put a dollar sign on it and figure out how to move ahead. That's what settlements do.
And I understand, and I believe that giving deference to a union, I understand the case law, but I also look at that there are certain cases, which I believe maybe this case is, where this court can clarify what is reasonable when you look at the total circumstances. And the total circumstances are that they weren't negotiating in good faith at the beginning to terminate a settlement. They only did this once the Illinois Brotherhood of Teamsters made it known that they had to drop a jurisdictional issue with the National Labor Relations Board. At that time, all of a sudden they're scurrying around and they're making out an agreement, and then it's a cram down. There's no...
So staying away from the facts of this case, what's the one-sentence rule of law that you're asking for, in our opinion?
I believe the rule of law would be that there is a limit to what unions can do that should be considered reasonable under any terms.
Not much predictive value in that rule. I mean, no one is going to know in the next case whether it's gone beyond or not.
And I believe it could be a case by case, but when we give them complete deference, where they can make any choice at the detriment of their union member with absolutely no restrictions, it's scary.
Well, there are restrictions. It's just that they're very... They're for the extreme case. They're the bad faith. I mean, the Supreme Court's talked about what the
fair. But that's the issue. Everybody comes, well, what is fair? Because there isn't really no case that says this is fair. It's
always, there are a lot of cases that say this isn't unfair, and that's what we drive.
That's always the way it works. It's not unfair, but never what is fair.
Well, gosh, then I think you'd have us sitting at settlement table with you.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
I think we'd have to be there, and we just are too busy.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you so much. Thanks to one and all, and the case will be taken under advisement. Oh.